Hi, welcome to another episode of the CTO to CTO podcast. Today, our guest is Karsten Thoma, investor, entrepreneur, and co-founder of Hybris, an e-commerce platform that pioneered the market back when less than 2% of global transactions were executed online. Some of the topics Karsten talks about are solving complex issues on a low budget, the importance of proximity to the customer, and how genuine and foolproof company culture is built. Let's begin.
In today's episode, we are going to talk about the early days of e-commerce platforms. I'm going to ask my guest, Karsten Thoma, founder of Hybris, about his journey from a small e-commerce startup to a market leader. How they found the product market fit, or rather how they built the market of enterprise-ready e-commerce platforms that didn't exist before. Karsten is a true e-commerce pioneer, successful entrepreneur, personally a very nice and humble person. Karsten, I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm going to enjoy that hour because it's really cold and rainy outside. So it's a good thing to sit in an office virtually with people.
Awesome, especially that nowadays is very difficult to meet otherwise. So the funny story, like I was wondering how to approach you and invite you to this interview, searching for some common contacts. This kind of stuff, because I was afraid that there is no other way to get in contact with you. But actually, I just sent you a message and you just replied saying like, okay, no problem, it's gonna be fun. And that was really cool. Thank you for that. It was very straightforward, very humble. I really like it. Thank you for being here with
sure,
us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Okay, cool. So let me just start with my questions. I guess that I don't have anything innovative to say about the company you founded, Hybris. We all knew it's unquestionable e-commerce leader in B2B, B2C, retail, telco, and all the other segments. But what I'm curious about is more like how it all started.
I guess we set a standard for commerce platforms. That's true. Looking back, how did it all start? It started from numerous directions. Mm-hmm. I was studying law still and worked for Hewlett Packard in parallel. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, I was basically responsible for a process mining, manual process mining and reengineering, what Celonis does today. Mm-hmm. for a certain group within HP. And when we published the results of our findings, I came across a technology where you could publish content on the intranet. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that you could publish it on the internet, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So there was this moment, where you have this strong conviction and where you get a glimpse into the future, mm-hmm. that almost makes you a bit uncomfortable because you know that something big is going to change if you're not like completely mistaken.
Yeah.
And so I took my chance and moved back to Munich and found the right co-founding partners and we just tried it, just went for it.
Gotcha. So I guess it was 1997, something like this?
Correct, yeah. It was 97, yeah.
Do you remember other e-commerce platforms that were on the market when you were starting?
I do. I actually do. There were quite some like small tools, mm-hmm. e-shop tools, mm-hmm. Out of the box that were like back then sold alongside magazines, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I think InShop was around with ePages also, mm-hmm. Like out of the box solution. I do believe that we were the first ones like looking at the commerce topic more from a holistic platform perspective. Uh-huh. Our technology group, ATG, mm-hmm. was pivoting at that moment or during that time too.
Yeah.
I do not exactly remember the year, but it must have been around the same time where they were more focused on B2C, but they had a very interesting approach to enterprise commerce as well. That's what I remember. And then a few years later, InShop with Infinity. Mm-hmm. for the B2C, in particular for B2C, was in that space too. Nevertheless, the focus on also like more complex industries in B2B, I think that was and stayed exclusive to us.
Interesting. So it's good that you mentioned it, because I think it was, and maybe still is, kind of USP for Hybris, like supporting all those more complex business model, not only B2C, which is pretty crowdy, regarding the e-commerce platforms. Mm-hmm. But I guess that then in 1990s, late 1990s, early 2000s, you were still in the kind of startup mode, looking for the product market fit, as all startups do, testing the first hypothesis. How this process looked like? Building the actual product and its fit to the market and searching for the USP. Do you remember those times? That's pretty interesting for me.
Oh, God, yeah, I do remember. I mean, look, we were building an ambitious product that delivered real value, right? Mm-hmm. And then the dot-com crash happened, mm-hmm. Which was completely unrelated to what we were doing. But obviously, it did drag the whole commerce topic down, right? And it did not only drag the whole commerce topic down, it also evaporated mm-hmm. the startup scene in Europe, and it also like extinguished like any like VC activities from professional VCs in particular. Some of the US companies who branched out into Europe for the first time, it was all gone afterwards. Mm-hmm. So we honestly didn't know what hit us. We were not in that business, right? We were like a substantial serious software player. On the way to becoming one, and we didn't know what hit us. Like, oh my God, what was that? And it hit us brutally. Mm-hmm. So we had to find a way in product market fit. And I would almost call it product market people fit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because we also had to operate with the people that we could attract back then.
Yeah.
And then given the macro trends in the market back then, it was not that easy. Mm-hmm. You know, there were not that many after what happened in the dot-com crash that wanted to work for an e-commerce startup. So we were kind of limited in how we could do things, and we realized that it was a little bit easier for us that the first wave of B2C retail marketing focused was like too close to the dot-com crash, and also in terms of people and talent that we attracted wasn't the right thing for us. So we had this we had to position the company almost one level down in the more complex platform and the more complex platform layer, which we did, right? But it was, I would call it product market people fit, because we had an additional dimension of complexity that we had to solve back then.
That's interesting. And have you focused on any particular market first? Like, was it Germany or any other market, or have you, started with thinking globally from the, day zero?
I mean, I always thought global, but back then that probably was not the right time.
To have
global visions. Global visions back then would have probably brought up some question marks with people. But Germany was earlier, but actually Switzerland showed early traction.
Oh, gotcha.
Almost a little bit sooner than Germany. I think the reason was Switzerland was a great fit for how we approached the topic, because Switzerland back then had a lot of global companies that had like specific products, complex products for specific industries that were market leaders, but the companies were still small. Mm-hmm. So you had to solve high complexity with limited budgets, right? Yeah. There was one company that produced test and measurement devices, right? Mm-hmm. Like a small company, but global market leader for test and measurement devices.
Gotcha.
So, so you basically were operating with a budget of a medium sized company, but you had to solve riddles that were enterprise grade. And I think that honestly was a good thing for our platform, because we solved those riddles, right? And Switzerland being able to deliver that, the company structure there rewarded us earliest. But then we obviously also at one point got a little traction in Germany and Austria as well. Yeah.
Absolutely, that's interesting. This plot about the Switzerland-based companies that were operating globally. Because I had a next question. Maybe you partially answered to it already. Because the question was how you avoided this temptation to be, you know, short midterm successful on just, you know, dark markets, which is always a trap that you can easily step into. And many different platforms did it, right? But you didn't. You just rolled out globally. So you think that this was the recipe for that? Or maybe you had some different approach to not be stuck into just, you know, dark?
No, we like honestly, like no matter what happened in which time, we always knew that software, in particular commerce, is going to be a global business, and it was our ambition to serve that globally. And this is how the software looked like. Quite honestly, that's how the software looked like in 2000 already. There were many changes along the way, and some things were too complex and almost too flexible. Mm-hmm. But it was always ingrained in the software: multi-language, multi-currency. Yeah. Multi-market enabled and be across industries and B2B to B2C. It's like if you want to become a platform and not a tool, right? Yeah. If you want to become the execution platform, that's what you got to do. And we believe that commerce is going to be the platform. Mm-hmm. We also believed, and that's why we had a very strong management console behind the front end, that commerce is going to be the new cockpit, how companies do business, yeah. Right? I mean, it was hard to believe back then, and honestly, also the vision was sometimes hard to articulate, and we probably have also not been particularly good at it, mm-hmm. right? Back mm-hmm. then, lack of experience, lack of confidence after what happened.
You were pioneering this market, so
yeah, but also less than 2% of transactions back then have been online. Yeah. So it was a big bet to assume that the commerce platform is going to be the platform, right?
Absolutely.
But it was a debate indeed, but in the end, I guess we were right.
Absolutely. I guess it was, you know, a pretty good bet. And then the UK-US market, where you grew up from 0 to 50 mil USD license revenue.
That was US only.
US only. Okay. So that's even more impressive, like 0 to 50 million USD in just under 24 months. What was your engine of growth?
That was really a masterpiece between many mm-hmm. like things that we did and many things that we had to react to. It was in between choice, like what to focus on. Mm-hmm. I think it was great that we did not got tempted mm-hmm. to go to the customers where everyone went, right?
Yeah.
So we literally picked the complex ones. We focused on complex SAP B2B accounts, and no one else could serve that. It was a very strong ecosystem play, and it was people, right? We managed to put a foundation in place in North America that was as strong as in the headquarter. Back in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit of everything. Like many things have to fall into place. Many little things that in hindsight were big bets, but all at the same time totally logical, right? As example, I picked New York as my main location. And back then in 2009, 2010, no one did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
If companies went to the US, they went to the West Coast.
Yeah.
It was clear.
Yeah.
Company goes to the US. It was like, no, I'm going to the West Coast. The target industries that we had back then that made Hype is most successful are not at the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
right? We didn't sell into media and high tech. That was not our core customer base.
Absolutely.
So why should I be at the West Coast? So at the East Coast was where our customer profile was sitting. Consumer packaged goods distribution, a B2B distribution, and then discrete manufacturing if we move more to the middle of the country, right? Yeah. And that's what I did, and I think it was the right thing to do. Proximity again, also to the customer.
That's interesting. Then you know, Boston become this, you know, hub of e-commerce for many different products. Also was born there, so the East Coast is getting more and more popular, but you were first there. Actually, that was my
first, and I'm Boston was existent already when I moved there. New York was not.
Gotcha.
But if you look at New York now, I think it is probably the more vibrant SaaS startup scene, even compared to Boston.
Absolutely. For European companies, it's pretty tough to do this, US expansion. Usually it takes, years, sometimes fails. How you made it? Like, you also acquired iCongo, right? Somewhere in this period.
That was 2011. Yeah, I mean, revenue-wise, the growth was all organic almost. We didn't initially we partnered with Endeca in the US, which was a marketing commerce platform for search and merchandising and personalization back then. Which gave us a good entryway into a customer base and also good access to enterprise grade sales force, right? Mm-hmm. Which Endeca had a very, very good one. That was basically accelerating our growth initially in the US market. Then from that moment on, we got a lot of traction and we had to think about how can we fuel that growth and also deliver the projects and satisfy our customers, and also get leapway into some additional industries, which we did with the iCongo acquisition. Right, it was not interesting for us from a revenue perspective because we knew that we're going to discontinue the product. So we migrated most customers at a substantial expense, but customer first was always key for us, and we were also a tremendous focus on our customers, but the iCongo organization had some strong elements that we then could turn into Hybris North America, which also was interesting because we had a clear headquarter then. It was Montreal, right? It was a big location. It was a good management team there. I'm still in touch with the people. That was a good move. It pretty much also avoided us falling into a trap of being understaffed, despite the explosive growth that we could see in those times. So it was all those elements. And again, it probably was a bold move, but we could convince the people, and they supported the story and the mission. That was a key element to what happened next, right?
Yeah, now it makes perfect sense. So thanks for this explanation. How you financed the growth at such a tremendous pace? I guess it would be difficult for even most successful company growing just organically to do such an expansion.
Yeah, I think it was kind of the horrific experience that we had to make after the .com crash,
absolutely.
The company was pretty much like more than bootstrapped for many years afterwards, and so we had an enormous discipline in our cost structure and spending behavior. So despite the triple digit growth that we achieved almost year after year, the company was running pretty much neutral, cash flow positive sometimes even. It was unbelievable. But I think the DNA that we had to develop during those dark years helped us a big deal.
Yeah.
In order to achieve that.
Amazing. Starting in the crisis has its pros too, seemingly.
Can only encourage people now to. Nevertheless, I mean, even what's happening now, there's no shortage of capital, right?
Yeah.
If you see what happened last week, shutting down a startup within a year after $1.5 billion of funding, it's probably exactly what happens if there's too much capital around. So I'm kind of thankful that we had to do it that way. I think it led to all types of success.
Absolutely. It prepared you for success in some way. with all those offices you had around the world, like US, Canada, Germany, Poland, I guess you are traveling a lot, aren't you? Like, how you manage to keep in under control the whole company when it was growing so rapidly?
I probably had many homes. Mm-hmm. Maybe one way to look at it is I traveled a lot. Maybe the other way is to say I had many homes. Mm-hmm. Many homes where I like took base and could support people. I mean, proximity and being present in those locations. Gotcha. And making sure, yeah, that people work amongst a certain like standard and culture. Mm-hmm. Was a key belief I had that this is important, mm-hmm, in particular because it grew so fast. And having that discipline and showing that presence and being consistent also on many things, I think, yeah, was probably one parameter that you have to set.
Yeah,
if you support such a growth story.
Yeah, that's a good point. My next question was actually about the culture, so we move smoothly to this point. I spoken to some folks that used to work at Hybris around mid 2000s. Now some of them are still working at SAP, and what is common in what they are saying is that the culture was really brilliant, very unique. Like, there was this feeling that everything is possible. So people were very, very encouraged to do bold things and push, you know, the limits. You already said that one of the vital reasons for that was to be present, to support them. Mm-hmm. Any other advice how you can set this kind of vibe and culture?
I mean, there's always, I mean, you always have to deal with certain growth pains, right? Yeah. There are some things that you cannot avoid. One thing that I always was fascinated by at the very end before we sold, but also like within SAP, when the unit that we were leading and spearheading was even bigger, right, mm-hmm, than what we brought into SAP, is the loss of productivity in some areas. When you knew, because you have been there like 10 years before, when you knew like that 10 years ago you could do this, the same output, like with one fifth of the resources, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. And I always was like, how is that possible? I mean, and I guess in particular back then, and I still believe it's a challenge today, despite the fact that there's more tooling and more data and insight that you can access, but I still believe that the way how sales, as example, is managed is much more data and result driven, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And it's much more ingrained in the culture, in the management culture, and it's always been like this. You have your quotas, you have your productivity, you have your ramp up, you have the quota achievement, right? You have, yeah, the account distribution and territory distribution. So it's just very established, right?
Yeah.
I think establishing similar productivity tools for R&D and other departments. We are on our way, and accessibility of data, I think, is supporting and enabling us more and more, but it's still not on the same level. It's still not on par. So this is, I think companies, the more you can access those enablement layers and tools, will be even able to grow faster and at higher productivity levels.
Gotcha.
So I think, mm-hmm, there's still a golden age of startups out there. The cultural question of that is a different story, right? It has nothing to do necessarily, or not always, has to do something with output.
Yep.
And culture is also something that I believe you cannot define.
Yep.
What you can define a system of virtues, right? And that system has to make sense for what you try to achieve, and that system has to be consistent. Mm-hmm. But that's how much, like, that's really, like, once you define that, that's how far the theory goes, mm-hmm, right? That's how far the theory goes.
Yeah.
That's not the end of the line, because then the hard part starts. You have to live that system, and you have to live those virtues in a way that is believable, right? It has to be authentic and it has to be without any failure.
Yeah.
Because once you fail that system, you basically take out the air in the room for creating culture.
Mm-hmm.
So culture is something that grows and that they can foster based on a system of virtues, and the culture gets stronger. I think the more people live that system and basically transport that
mm-hmm.
message also to other layers and parts of the organization, and you have to live that like every second and in every decision. Like there's no,
that's,
if you want
yeah.
to create something like this, that is exactly what's a prerequisite, and you have to create the right gravitas for people, and you have to make sure that if you have a system of virtues, that the people that you hire and the people that you work with attract the same type of people. And if you make mistakes, you have to correct it.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Thank you for this answer. I think it's something which is always easier to said than done. So
that's exactly what I said.
The hard part
comes after you define it. It's you have to live it.
You need to live it. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I suppose the next phase of hybrid development was the acquisition by SAP. Would you like to tell us more about it?
It was tough. It was a tough moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The company was growing tremendously. Commerce was becoming more and more mainstream.
Yeah.
And we had good visibility. We had good visibility how to further grow the company.
Mm-hmm.
We also had visibility of probably what would not have sustained from an organizational perspective and strategy perspective mm-hmm. for further growth and the public markets as well. But we had a plan, but we had a lot of stakeholders that got too flattered
mm-hmm.
by those offers, right? And at one point, the pressure was just very high, and also the deal and the integration scenario was very attractive,
mm-hmm.
and we could really see, despite the fact that we had other plans and dreams as a standalone company too, but we really could see that SAP could help us achieving the goals that we had for Hybris, really manifesting our position
mm-hmm.
as a global standard for B2B and B2C enterprise commerce, and that's when we finally or eventually supported the decision. And a few quarters after the acquisition, SAP basically lived up to their promise, and Hybris became the key pillar for the complete front office,
mm-hmm.
right? Which was a big deal. It was almost like a reverse integration.
Yeah, awesome. So it was a great decision for the product, absolutely. But as a founder, when you eventually left the company, how was your mm-hmm. your how did you feel? Like how is to restart, redefine your career? Because you know you were engaged with Hybris for so many years, and it, mm-hmm. it just ended one moment, right?
Yeah, and the opportunity and platform that SAP gave us was attractive. There was a lot of entrepreneurial room to move still
mm-hmm.
For me. But obviously, yeah, you got to face it. I mean, I became a GM, right? I was CEO of that unit. I became GM of that group at one point, and it was a classic GM role in a large enterprise
mm-hmm.
with a substantial P&L responsibility. And you got to perform. That's what we did. We accelerated the trajectory, growth trajectory, and we outperformed the model that they had for us.
Mm-hmm.
We also revitalized the broader front office vision within SAP, and it was an amazing continuation of the success story.
Yeah,
and I learned a lot. I mean, it was a pretty interesting journey for me, from founding the company to ending up with a multi-billion dollar P&L and succeeding in that too. Like mm. like from founder to entrepreneur to executive staying a founder and then become a corporate executive is pretty much every facet of the technology and software world that you can live. And if you are blessed after a tough start to live that successfully, it was incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, gotcha. But after you exit, I guess that your career changed but not ended. How did you redefine it after exiting SAP?
I think I adopted and changed all of the time. Like, a career is always constant change, and I always knew that I'm gonna start investing, and I did that already during my active executive career. But I also knew that I need some pockets of engagement that are meaningful and deep enough that I can deploy some of the experiences that I made over more than two decades. Yeah. And so while I have a large portfolio of tech companies that I'm invested in, I have a very small number of companies where I'm deeply engaged. Where I know so much about the companies, which in particular means people, product, and market, that I can truly contribute value. Mm-hmm. So it's probably too far to call it mini executive roles, but it's definitely just something that's meaningful enough that it also intellectually and from an entrepreneurial passion perspective is very rewarding.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. What's your investment strategy, if I may ask?
Usually, very, very strong discipline in investing in products that I do understand, where I understand the market, where I kind of like can prove the market, data-driven approach, and then try to prove the team and make sure you invest in the right people.
Gotcha.
It's like a very, very strong focus. I really do not try to invest in things where I don't have a deep understanding. And that is what I do indirectly through funds, right? When I'm an LP in funds, there are certain topics that I found interesting and fascinating, but where I do not do direct investments because I feel I have a lack of understanding in some markets. The markets where I get active and proactive with direct investments and also active engagements are the markets that I understand best, which in the broader sense is B2C, B2B SaaS, enterprise SaaS.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you for sharing this. I have a few more general questions. I usually ask the same questions to my guests and never got the same answer. So the first question is about the future of e-commerce enterprise software market. It's changing a lot, especially in the last few years, with movements like headless, microservices, other buzzwords, sometimes overhyped. How do you see the future of this software market for enterprise e-commerce?
That's a broad question. I think there are many overhyped topics right now. The equation might be fairly simple. We still have a very small percentage of transactional volume that is going through commerce platforms, and I think the assumption that at one point it looks inverse, right? Like at one point, 85% go through online and 15% are not within a commerce platform is probably the reality. Mm-hmm. 10 more years down the road, maybe sooner, maybe later, I don't know.
No.
If you make that assumption, there is a long, 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 long phase coming where you have to solve increasing complexity, mass data, process optimization. These are all elements that for now are still underrepresented in commerce platforms. So while I have a clear picture of the waves that are coming and that will happen, I think it's almost impossible to predict how the market and market landscape looks like.
Gotcha.
It's just going to stay super exciting. There's a lot of markets that are still completely underserved. And even the markets that you would consider mature are not mature because the numbers are still small to what compared to what they could be,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting answer. So you say that we have such a low penetration of e-commerce still that as it grow up in the next year, it will redefine the product that we even have on the market, because they will need to support so many different industries that are now under supported.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And when you look at the e-commerce platform, or maybe general e-commerce software, not only platforms, at the moment, do you see any trends that are under and overhyped? There's,
today.
If you open G2 Crowd or any other portal comparing different products, there's a lot of buzzwords everywhere, right? Every product has its unique USP based on some.
I do think headless is overhyped.
Uh huh.
Right. It's like I compare it always. If you look at the principle a little bit. Like everything comes back in software, right?
Yeah.
It's in a different form in the next generation. I compare it to the enterprise Java Beans hype 20 years ago, right? It was the best thing, like utmost flexibility. The functional package is small enough to be used anywhere, only that people found out that it was too complicated to deploy.
Yep.
I'm not saying headless is the same, but if one truth about commerce is that volume will increase and complexity will increase, then headless is only one part of the equation, right?
Yeah.
Solving commerce in advanced industries and that complexity that will come also into current industries that are of higher maturity is the challenges are not being solved through headless. That's one observation that I can share.
Yeah, that's absolutely something I can agree with. I guess it's just a solution for some category of problems, not all the problems.
Correct, exactly. But it's not a merit and badge of honor for positioning of a company that's in the commerce space.
Yeah.
The customers that they have to serve have other problems further down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is under hype? That should be more emphasized than it's not.
So solving commerce in advanced industries with higher complexity and even bigger data streams. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had an interview with Matt Gurniak from Trikit. They are doing this AR tools for presenting the product. Mm-hmm. But before he created a CPQ for Salesforce, and
Steelbrick, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was telling me exactly the same thing, like that they were aiming for the problems that were always there, but nobody wanted to solve them because they were too complex. And if you solve such a problem, you can be a leader. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good company. I know them. Good guys.
Absolutely. Okay. My last question is, what is the biggest learning of your professional career? If there is a single one.
Adopting.
What do you mean?
You have to have the willingness to adopt and make this part of the journey and don't complain about it. It's like it's part of the excitement and accept that it's part of what it is.
Yeah.
And while you adopt, that doesn't mean that you should change your goals. That's different. You have to be very clear. You have to be very clear about what your goals are, and if they're the right goals that you need also, and then adopting is part of the journey to achieve those goals, right?
Gotcha.
I mean, it's something that always worked well for me, but then also I knew when it did not work anymore, right? And that's when I left. And I knew that there's no way how I can how I can align the goals with what was going on in life. And then I realized when I tried that I didn't have the willingness to adopt to a degree that would have been necessary to achieve them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the opportunity to reconsider, and that's when I made the decision to leave, and it was great. It was a perfect timing, like perfect year, breaking through a billion in net new bookings at a massive growth rate, and finding such an end. And to some degree, I was prepared since I exited Hybris in 2013, right, when I sold it. And I think I was always very conscious of that process.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking time for this interview.
Thank you. Have a good one. Thanks for having me. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. If you enjoyed this show and if you found this episode useful and informative in any way, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This can help us tremendously in reaching other listeners who might also be interested in these topics. And of course, as always, we'll be back with great content next week.